Today at Reader's Corner, Daniel James Brown, author of The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics.
There's no easy way to the top of this sport. It requires an absolute degree of perseverance and resilience, of psychological toughness. In the 20s and the 30s, the Ivy League schools pretty much dominated rowing, sort of socially elite sport, and crews from Washington started beating them. Eight rowers going at it at the highest level of competition possible, the Olympic level. And it's hard to overstate just how fit one has to be to row at this kind of level.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In the summer of 1936, in the midst of the Great Depression, the world was transfixed by the grandeur of the Olympic Games in Berlin and by a determined group of young Americans who were giving their all to bring home the gold. In front of high-ranking Nazi officials, including Adolf Hitler, they overcame impossible odds to snatch victory from both the German and Italian crews in the game's signature rowing event. The team was from the University of Washington in Seattle. What shocked Hitler and rowing enthusiasts around the world was the humble origin of this nine-man crew. They were not elite athletes born to wealth and privilege, but the poor sons of mill workers and loggers who trained by wielding axes and baling hay. Their modest circumstances reaffirmed the American ideal that hard work and passion trump affluence on the road to success. Today's guest, author Daniel James Brown, recalls the team's three-year odyssey in his New York Times bestseller, The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. The book, now out in paperback, recounts the team's challenges and triumphs as they took on and defeated the nation's top rowing teams. With each victory, they moved one step closer to their Olympic goal. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Daniel James Brown. He lives outside of Seattle, Washington, where we reached him by phone for this interview. Daniel James Brown, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Dan, I'm going to begin with a quote from Chapter 5. It's a quote of George Yeoman Pocock, who is one of the central figures of this book. We'll talk about him later and the incredible influence he had over these boys and the coaches. But he says, "Rowing is perhaps the toughest of sports. Once the race starts, there are no timeouts, no substitutions. It calls upon the limits of human endurance. The coach must therefore impart the secrets of the special kind of endurance that comes from mind, heart, and body." Why don't we start with a little bit about rowing? Those of us who didn't either grow up on the coast or spend a lot of time on the coast may not have the same familiarity as you might if you're along the West Coast or the East Coast. So why don't we just start out with rowing in its basics. Tell us about the sport of rowing, how the boat is set up, who's in it, how many guys, what positions they have in that boat.
Well, in this case, we're talking about an eight-man or eight-woman boat. So that's eight rowers with a coxswain. And, of course, the eight rowers are facing backwards. The only person who can see where the boat is going is the coxswain, generally a very small man or woman, steering the boat and calling out commands to set the rhythm of the boat, the count of the strokes per minute. And it's enormously popular on both coasts, but you'd be surprised actually now how many club rowers there are all across America. Actually, I've been astonished since the book came out. I'm getting emails from rowers in Oklahoma and Arizona and Nevada and all sorts of places where you might not think there were any rowers to be found. But as I say, in this case, we're talking about eight rowers going at it at the highest level of competition possible, the Olympic level. And it is really, it's an absolutely Herculean task. It's hard to overstate just how fit one has to be in order to row at this kind of level. Basically, it puts stress on every muscle in the body. It demands tremendous ability to absorb and process oxygen. So it's a pretty much an elite sport at the very highest levels. And people who manage to pull it off are both excellent physical specimens and also there's a certain kind of mental toughness that goes into it. In order to be good at this, you have to get out and row at usually at 5 in the morning. And in the case of us here in Seattle, it's out on Lake Washington, rowing all winter in sleet and snow and, worst of all, very cold, cutting winds. And so it's something that you have to be driven to do. There's no easy way to the top of this sport, and it requires an absolute degree of perseverance and resilience, of, you know, psychological toughness. And that's one of the things that these 9 kids in this Washington boat in 1936 had.
Well, one of the things that impresses me about reading the book is how this is a sport where there's really no individual heroes, at least in the act of rowing. It's totally a team sport. Nobody walks away getting a little more credit than the other guy. However, or gal, there is, however, a power spot, the number 8 spot. Help us understand what that's all about.
Yeah, it's called the stroke oar, and the stroke is usually a very powerful rower, but he or she also has to be technically proficient, because everybody in the boat is basically following the stroke rhythm and degree of force of the person sitting in front of him in the boat. So starting at the back of the boat towards the coxswain, the stroke oar sets the pace, the rate at which he is stroking, the degree of force he is exerting on the oar gets replicated all up through the length of the boat, each person copying what he sees happening in front of him, basically. So the stroke has to be an extraordinary oarsman, just very, very technically proficient, very powerful, and most of all, very, very reliable. Rowing is, you know, ideally, the oars are going in and out of the water almost like a metronome, with just absolute perfect synchronization. So it's absolutely a critical position in the boat.
You mentioned the growth of club sports earlier, being the college president who has to keep track of conferences, and I understand that you don't. I'm curious as to whether or not this sport has spread beyond what you really spend most of your time in this book referring to, the Ivy League and the Pac-12. Is that basically where you find most of the intercollegiate rowing happening, or has it spread beyond that as well, just like the club sports?
It has spread, yeah. I mean, and that's actually part of the story of this book, is that in the 20s and the 30s, the Ivy League schools pretty much dominated rowing. It was considered an East Coast sport and a sort of socially elite sport. And the crews from both Cal Berkeley and particularly Washington in the late 20s and early 30s started beating them at their national championships back in Poughkeepsie, New York. And this crew in particular just absolutely stunned the East Coast. And that began a sort of a democratization of the sport, and on collegiate level and the club level. And actually, you would be surprised. As I say, I think Arizona State has a crew, for instance. It has spread on both the club level and the collegiate level. I think there are probably many, many more people rowing now than did in the 20s and 30s, even though the exact opposite is true in terms of crowd appeal. In the 20s and 30s, 100,000 people would turn out on Lake Washington on a Saturday afternoon to watch a crew race. And now it's, you know, a much smaller number of people that come out to watch it. But I think probably many more people actually participate in the sport now than did then.
So what accounted for that? I was shocked when you talked about some of the numbers of the crowds that would show up for these races back in the 1930s. I guess what maybe it's the fact that we didn't have 24-hour sports coverage in as many sports teams then as we did.
I think that's really what it comes down to. As you say, on any given Saturday or Sunday, you can flip on your TV and choose from dozens of NBA or NFL or MLB or college football games and get them in spectacular living color. And I just don't think there was that kind of competition in the 1920s and 30s. The idea of going out and having a picnic lunch on the banks of Lake Washington or the Hudson River and watching a crew race was very attractive, partly because there wasn't the alternatives that we have today, and partly because I think people have just sort of lost track of how dramatic Crewe actually is. A lot of the drama in Crewe takes place in the boat. There are sometimes races that are also very dramatic to watch. But a lot of it comes from knowing the individual oarsmen or oarswomen and what they go through. And as I say, the drama that unfolds in a boat during the course of a race. So, you know, I think the short answer to that question is basically that there's just so many competing forms of entertainment, not just sports, but entertainment in general.
You know, I want to stick with this issue of the 1936 team and compare it to other Olympics and maybe why there wasn't as much attention. But you mentioned the drama in the boat. The first thing I think of is this very sick young man who's in the boat right there in the last race, the gold medal race. Recount that for us. What happened there?
Yeah, Don Yum, the stroke oar, was terribly ill, had been ill in bed with a high fever for days. And on the day of the Olympic gold medal race in Berlin, all sorts of things went wrong for these kids from Washington. First of all, Yum was, as I say, so sick he could barely hold himself up. But at the last moment, they decided to put him in the boat. There were 75,000 fans there, mostly German fans, chanting, Deutschland, Deutschland, Deutschland. Hitler came into the regatta grounds, and the crowd switched over to chants of Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil. So it was a very intimidating environment. Although the Americans had turned in the fastest qualifying time, they were assigned the outermost lane on the race course, lane 6, which meant they had to row out into the face of a very stiff quartering headwind. The German and Italian boats, the two fascist powers, had turned in slow qualifying times, but they were assigned lanes 1 and 2, which were entirely sheltered from the wind. And then on top of all that, the Americans, because they were out in the windy part of the course, didn't hear the start call, and so they didn't know the race had started until they saw the boats off to their left surging forward. So they got off to this horrible start, and Don Yum, the stroke, was so ill, he just couldn't respond to the commands from Bob Mock, the coxswain. So by 1,000 meters down the course, halfway through the race, they were dead last. The Italians and the Germans were streaking down the inside lanes, and it looked as if there was simply no way in the world that they could even place in the race, let alone win. And now, it's no secret, you know from the time you pick up the book that in fact they did win that race. But what's really extraordinary is that second 1,000 meters and what happened there. And I like to leave that to the readers to discover when they pick up the book.
Sure. You're listening to Daniel James Brown, the author of The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. Now, backing up a bit, before they actually got into the boat, wasn't there a suggestion that Don Yum step aside?
Yeah.
And the team intervened there.
Yeah, it was cute. Yum was so sick that Al Ulbrichtsen, the American coach, the Washington coach, just said, there's no way, he can't row, he can hardly hold his head up. And so he kept putting substitutes in the boat, and the boat just didn't go the way they wanted it to go, and the other guys in the boat just really not happy with that at all. So the night before the gold medal race, they went to Al Ulbrichtsen. Now, Al Ulbrichtsen was a very stern man. He did not brook insubordination, or he was not easy to challenge. But these kids, they went to Ulbrichtsen, and they said, Coach, you got to put Don Yum in the boat. Tie him to the gunwales if you have to. We'll prop him up, but he's got to be in the boat. And at the very last minute, Ulbrichtsen relented and put him in the boat as sick as he was. And Ulbrichtsen believed that was, you know, the seal of doom. He thought there's no way that this kid can row, let alone set the pace for the whole race. But as I say, things worked out in a rather remarkable way.
So in Seattle, there's no question that the 1936 Olympic rowing team was what everybody was watching when it comes to those games. But there was something larger than life overshadowing the 1936 Olympic games and the accomplishments of one American in particular. Help us understand why there was a bit of competition here when it comes to the average American knowing what went on at those games.
Right. Well, of course, the Jesse Owens story dominated the headlines all across America, including in Seattle that summer. And with good reason, it's an absolutely great story. You know, it's one of those stories that we've held on to all these years because I think it reminds us of what we value and who we are. But it was a story of a great individual achievement, and I think this is another story that reminds us actually of who we are and what we value. I think it reminds us that Americans are actually pretty good at building great teams, and this is a story that doesn't celebrate an individual achievement; it celebrates a great team achievement. But yes, because of the Jesse Owens story and a number of other factors. When the kids came back after winning the gold medal, when they came back to Seattle, it was the middle of the Depression. So they had to go about the business of trying to find a job to get through another year at school. So most of them just put their gold medals in a sock drawer someplace and went on about their lives. And the story never really got told fully, even here in Seattle. People of a certain age in Seattle do remember it, and I've been, pleased at how excited they've been that the story's come back to life. But nationally, certainly, the story was eclipsed by the Jesse Owens story.
And I understand that this story may be up on the big screen.
Yeah, Weinstein Company, which made The King's Speech and a number of other Oscar-winning films lately, has bought the film rights, and they are working on a script. And I haven't seen that; don't know much about what it's going to look like. But they are moving forward with it, so I'm very excited about that. Uh-huh. Of course.
Well, back to how this story might have been shadowed a bit by the Jesse Owens victory at the 1936 Olympics, and the fact that it was never really told in the manner you've told it here in this book. This is about a guy named Joe Rantz, and it sounds to me from reading the backstory to your book that none of this would have happened, perhaps, if it wasn't for the fact that you ended up with a neighbor whose dying father was this Joe Rantz.
Yeah, it was amazing the way this story came to me. It literally walked into my life. About 6 years ago, one of my neighbors, a lady I knew only as Judy at the time, came to me and she said her father was living at her home but under hospice care. He was in the last couple of months of his life, and she'd been reading one of my earlier books to him, and he wanted to meet me. So I went down a few days later to her house, and I met this guy named Joe Rantz. And we talked a little bit about that earlier book, but then he started talking about his experience growing up during the Depression, and he had a particularly heartrending story to tell about that. He was actually abandoned by his father and stepmother in 1929, just at the beginning of the Depression, and wound up literally having to forage in the woods for food in order to survive.
You know, before you go on, I just want to make a comment here. I've run into somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 15 people. People are always asking me, what are you reading for next week, and what's your book that's coming up? Every time I mention this book, first of all, like I said, I normally don't get a really great reaction from people because some of these books are brand new out on the shelf and they haven't had a chance to see them. But in your case, I've never had so many people say, oh, yeah, I've got the book. Isn't that an incredible read? And the very first place they start is this abandonment. They cannot imagine, even though it's a Depression era and you did a valiant job of trying to put this moment in the context of the Depression and what parents were facing. This is still a 16-year-old boy that gets home from school one day and the car is packed and his entire family walks out. I mean, that's unforgivable in my mind and frankly in the minds of almost everybody who picked up your book.
Yeah, it is. It was absolutely stunning. And to this day, 75 years later, Judy, his daughter, whenever we were talking about that part of the story, would start crying. And Joe teared up when he was telling it to me that first day. It was absolutely scarring. But it had a bearing, I think, on what happened later. Because Joe then went on to start talking about how he'd come to row for the University of Washington in 1933 and what that had meant to him, and how ultimately he and his crewmates had wound up rowing for this gold medal in Berlin against this German boat, amongst others. And as he started talking about the rowing and the boat and these other kids in the boat, he would tear up. He had teared up when he talked about the abandonment, but he teared up even more when he began to talk about these other guys, these other boys in the boat. And by the time he was done, I was practically in tears myself. It was just so moving the way he felt about these other kids and what had happened and what they had all become together. So I actually asked him that very day. I didn't go down there looking for a book topic, but I asked him that first day. I said, Joe, can I write a book about your life? And he thought for a moment, he shook his head, and he said, no, I don't want you to write a book about me, but you can write a book about the boat. And by the boat, he meant the whole of them, the summation of them, the totality of what they all were together. And so that's what I set out to do. It took 4 years of research, but that's sort of the spirit that I tried to imbue in the book.
You're listening to Daniel James Brown. He's the author of The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. Through his daughter and Joe himself, I guess, you learned that he just didn't complain about his circumstances. How did he handle that when people asked him, you know, aren't you mad? What did you do about this?
Yeah, you know, he was just one of those people that, and, you know, I think this kind of typical of that generation who went through the Depression. He just didn't see any point in talking about hard times or lingering on bad feelings. They were clearly there. You could see it in the way he teared up. But he was very optimistic and very forward-looking. And Judy, in particular, tells me that all his life he was that way. He just was an optimist, and he wanted to move on. He didn't really want to talk about things that had happened to him before. He was interested in moving forward.
And he was such a man of enormous character that a few years later, after he's on his feet and he's at the University of Washington, he's now looking out for his father and his stepmother, and especially his stepsisters and brothers, right?
Yeah, well, he finally finds where his parents, his father and his stepmother, had turned up in Seattle. And again, it was a depression, and they had no money and no jobs or anything. And they were pretty dysfunctional. The stepmother and the father would take off and leave the kids, the other kids, Joe's half-siblings, alone in the house and for days at a time, untended. And Joe discovered this, so he and his then-girlfriend, Joyce, started hanging out with the kids whenever their parents would disappear for a few days. Joe and Joyce would go over to the house and watch over the kids and make sure they had food and stuff. So he and Joyce became sort of guardian angels for Joe's half-siblings.
Well, and Joyce, who turned out to be his longtime wife, was Joe's guardian angel through all of this as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Joyce was a jewel. You know, they met on the school bus on the way to school, I think, in junior high school. I mean, they knew each other from way back before the abandonment. But after the abandonment, Joyce began to look out for Joe. She was the one person who had Joe's back through all that. And really, for the rest of their lives, she had Joe's back in a way that, again, it's hard to describe, but she was just so good for him and so good to him. And they were just an adorable couple. When Joyce was dying many, many, many years later in old age, Joe happened to also be in the hospital because he had broken a hip. And they moved their two beds together so Joe could hold Joyce's hand as she was dying. They were just inseparable.
There are so many aspects in Joe's early career at the University of Washington where he took on these unbelievable jobs. I mean, aside from the fact that he's working out in the boat, he took this one job. Actually, it was at a quarry where the Grand Coulee Dam was being built. Tell us about what that entailed.
Oh, man, that was a really interesting chapter in Joe's life, and I think in the book. It was the summer of 1935, and you know, Joe was constantly looking for a little bit of money. He could barely afford to put himself through university. In fact, he had to remain on crew if he was going to get through, because being on crew assured him of a part-time job on the campus. But he had to work, of course, every summer and get every penny he could. So that summer of 1935, they were beginning work on the Grand Coulee Dam in eastern Washington. And so Joe went out there and signed on, and they put him in a harness with a jackhammer and lowered him over the edge of a cliff. And he spent his days pounding away at this rock face of this cliff, you know, shaping the contours of the cliff so that the dam would fit where it was supposed to go. It was brutally hot, brutally difficult work. But Joe absolutely thrived on it, and it's part of what developed his upper body, of course, and made him as strong as he was. And also, during that time out at Grand Coulee that summer, he happened to find that two of his two other rowers from the University of Washington were out there doing the same thing, Chuck Day and Johnny White. And he had not particularly known them at the Shell House in Washington, but because they were all from Washington True, they got to know each other. They hung out, and they spent their weekends together, and they had this glorious time out there just being young and carefree and guys doing stuff. And it really, the three of them became bonded together by that, and ultimately all three of them wound up in this boat that went to Berlin. And so that was sort of the beginning of the healing process for Joe, of finding other people who he could trust after his abandonment.
Do I remember that most of the crew were actually engineering majors, and why'd that happen?
I don't know why. I guess it's coincidence, or perhaps that was just a very popular major for men in that era. But yes, and I don't remember the exact number, but I think at least five out of the eight were engineering students. And that's how Joe got to know Roger Morris, one of his other close friends on the crew. They were all in the engineering department, all had an interest in engineering. And I think partly because of that, after they graduated, they all ultimately wound up working at Boeing, designing aircraft at some point or another.
Well, that's an interesting point, because one of the things I noticed when you were talking about one of the Brits in the competition, I believe he went on to serve in World War II, and all of a sudden it occurred to me, wow, I don't think any of these guys did. Well, at least one did. You can clarify that. But most of them wound up working in the aerospace industry and the defense industry. And needless to say, there were engineers needed stateside. But this is like the greatest generation that didn't go to war.
Yeah, I had the same thing. Partway through the book, it suddenly occurred to me, well, you know, nine young men of that age, they must have all served in the war. And in fact, only one of them, I think it was Shorty Hunt, served in the Seabees as an engineer. The others, I know that two of them were refused induction because they were too tall. Apparently there was a height limit, even going into the war. They were told they were too tall. And several of the others, I think the reason that they wound up at Boeing designing aircraft rather than in a trench someplace in Germany was that they just desperately needed young engineers to design, you know, aircraft for the war effort in the Seattle area. And I think that's what happened there.
So is height a great advantage in the rowing sport?
Oh, it is, because you get much more leverage on the oar going through the water if you're tall. It's not impossible for a shorter man or woman to row, but generally speaking, height is a huge advantage, yeah.
We've run out of time for today's program, but next week we'll continue our conversation with Daniel James Brown about his fascinating book, The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.